I, the preacher, have been king over Israel in Jerusalem. And I applied my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. It is an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. I've seen everything that is done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and a striving after wind. What is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be counted. I said in my heart, I have acquired great wisdom, surpassing all who were over Jerusalem before me, and my heart has had great experience of wisdom and knowledge. And I applied my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceive that this also is but a striving after wind. For in much wisdom is much vexation, and he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure. Enjoy yourself. But behold, this also was vanity. I said of laughter, it is mad, and of pleasure, what use is it? I search with my heart now to cheer my body with wine, my heart still guiding me with wisdom, and how to lay hold on folly, till I might see what was good for the children of man to do under heaven during the few days of their life. I made great works. I built houses and planted vineyards for myself. I made myself gardens and parks and planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. I made myself pools from which to water the forest of growing trees. I bought male and female slaves and had slaves who were born in my house. I had also great possessions of herds and flocks, more than any who were before me in Jerusalem. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the treasure of kings and provinces. I got singers, both men and women, and many concubines, the delight of the sons of man. So I became great and surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also my wisdom remained with me, and whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I kept my heart from no pleasure, for my heart found pleasure in all my toil, and this was the reward for all my toil. Then I considered all that my hands had done and the toil I had expended in doing it. And behold, all was vanity and a striving after wind, and there was nothing to be gained under the sun. So I turned to consider wisdom and madness and folly. For what can the man do who comes after the king? Only what has already been done. Then I saw that there is more gain in wisdom than in folly, as there is more gain in light than in darkness. The wise person has eyes in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. And yet I perceive that the same event happens to all of them. Then I said in my heart, what happens to the fool will also happen to me. Why then have I been so very wise? And I said in my heart that this also is vanity. For of the wise, as of the fool, there is no enduring remembrance. Seeing that in the days to come, all will have been long forgotten. How the wise dies just like the fool. So I hated life, because what is done under the sun was grievous to me, for all is vanity and a striving after wind. I hated all my toil in which I toil under the sun, seeing that I must leave it to the man who will come after me. And who knows whether he will be wise or a fool? Yet he will be master of all for which I toiled and used my wisdom under the sun. This also is vanity. So I turned about and gave my heart up to despair over all the toil of my labors under the sun. Because sometimes a person who has toiled with wisdom and knowledge and skill must leave everything to be enjoyed by someone who did not toil for it. This also is vanity and a great evil. What has a man from all the toil and striving of heart with which he toils beneath the sun? For all his days are full of sorrow, and his work is a vexation. Even in the night his heart does not rest. This also is vanity. There is nothing better for a person than that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. This also I saw is from the hand of God. For apart from him, who can eat or who can have enjoyment? For to the one who pleases him, God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy. But to the sinner, he has given the business of gathering and collecting, only to give to the one who pleases God. This also is vanity and a striving after wind. Thank you. Do keep these open. We've got some headings there which will help you as we look at this text together. Can we really make a lasting difference in this life? That's the question I've put on the inside of your sheets. It's a question that we started looking at last week because it was there in chapter 1, verse 3. What does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? And I take it that whatever stage of life each of us must be in, we're all interested in this question of how it is we can make a difference in this life. What's worthwhile? What can we invest in? And it's that question that this preacher in Ecclesiastes wants us to think about and to dwell on these two chapters. And if you were here last week, we saw that the writer here, he pushes back on any assumption that we might have that we can make any lasting difference in this world. Do you remember the generations come, the generations go, and there seems to be apparent progress, we saw last week, but nothing really is new or lasting. And today he's carrying on with the same question. And today he's bringing some new evidence to the table. And this time he's doing it especially from his own experience. I take it that many of us spend much of our lives effectively climbing a hill towards a goal. It may be different for different ones of us. Perhaps there's that goal of career advancement, or family, or financial security, or a good reputation, or whatever it is. And we keep getting told by various people, keep going. Yes, it's tough where you are, but the view from the top is going to make it all worth it. And actually, that's the reason we are so interested, aren't we, in the testimonies of those who have made it to the top, to find out whether the hype is real, and to find out whether this life we're living really is worth it. So we ask the experts, we ask the Bill Gateses or the Mark Zuckerbergs, or we ask the lottery winner, or we ask the celebrity, or we ask the friend who's just made partner in the firm, what is it like up there? Is the view really worth the climb? And sometimes people are quite honest about it and they say, well, no, actually, it's a bit of an anticlimax. The view wasn't really worth it. And sometimes they conclude that maybe they haven't yet got high enough and they're going to push on. Or sometimes they conclude that they need to try and climb a different hill altogether. I'm thinking of people like Russell Brand. He was asked on a Newsnight interview by Jeremy Paxman, what happens when fame arrives? And Russell Brand replied, it's as if you'd acquired a pair of shoes that you'd long craved, and then you realize that the shoes are too tight. Some people are honest like that. But occasionally, you get folk who have sufficient ability and sufficient wealth and sufficient drive to make it their life's work to climb all of the hills there are, to do for the rest of humanity, to discover conclusively for everyone out there what really is worthwhile and what is purposeful and lasting in this life. Now, this writer here, the writer of Ecclesiastes, was uniquely qualified for this investigation, as we're going to see. And he did his work very thoroughly, and he did it very reliably, so that for all the rest of us, halfway up the hill, wherever it is, climbing the slopes, we can take his word for it and not live in a delusion. And Solomon, as I think it is who's writing, he gives his conclusion up front in chapter 1. And it's in two stages I put there on your sheets. Claim number one, God has frustrated this life. Claim number two, and even wisdom can't bring ultimate gain. And then he goes on, I think, to follow up with the evidence for his two claims in chapter 2. So that's what we're going to look at now. First, we'll start with number one, God has frustrated this life. Let's look again, verse 12. I, the preacher, have been king over Israel in Jerusalem. Now we have him again introduced, the preacher king. And again, I think this is most likely King Solomon. And the Bible says Solomon was uniquely gifted by God in wisdom. And as king of Israel, and this was at the nation's absolute peak, he was uniquely resourced to investigate. Look at verse 13. And I applied my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. You see, Solomon didn't waste his time. He didn't waste what he was given. He set himself the highest challenge imaginable with his wisdom. He wants a theory of everything. And this is his conclusion. Halfway through 13, it is an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. I've seen everything that is done under the sun, and behold, all is, do you remember that word? We thought it should be translated vapor or mist, vanity, and a striving after wind. And then he ends with a proverb, which is a kind of writing that Solomon particularly enjoyed. What is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be counted. And later in the book, 7:13 makes it clear that it's God who has made this world crooked and lacking. And so Solomon's claim here, I'll put on the sheet, is that God has frustrated this life. I don't know if for you that is difficult language. It's very negative, isn't it? Why would God be so negative? Why would God deliberately make things hard for people, we ask? And I think it's worth saying that there is a kind of a Christianity around whose starting position is, well, if I'm going to believe in a God, it must be a God who wants me to have a nice life. And then everything else is reasoned from that starting position. You probably heard that kind of argument if you were looking at all at the synod debates earlier this month. God must want me to gratify all my urges. Therefore, we must find a way to interpret the Bible to fit with that. That's the kind of starting position. God must want me to have a nice life. But the God of the Bible isn't like that. Thankfully, he is not an indulgent parent who just endorses whatever it is his creatures happen to want, whether it's good for them or not. God is actually a loving parent who teaches that actions have consequences. And when the first human beings rebelled, he disciplined them and he cursed this world. Not forever, but until a savior could come to forgive and to reconcile the rebels before ultimately setting the whole creation free again from its bondage to corruption. We saw that in the children's slot, didn't we, from Romans 8. David Attenborough has said that he can't believe in God because, he says, why would God create a world in which there are parasitic worms which make people blind? And you may have heard Stephen Fry makes almost exactly the same argument about bone cancer in children. How can you believe in God? Now, I think if we believe in the God whose great aim in life is to give me a nice life, then those are pretty powerful objections. What's God doing? Why couldn't he make a better world than he has done? But of course, the Bible speaks not only of a world which was created perfect, but crucially, and we saw this in our Old Testament reading, of a world now under God's curse. A world in which parasitic worms and bone cancer and futility and frustration are exactly what we should expect in this age. As we heard in our Genesis 3 reading, cursed is the ground because of you. This whole creation cursed. And inevitably that's going to affect our experience of work. In pain you shall eat of it all the days of your life. God has explained exactly why the world is the way it is. But surely, we say, if I follow God's pattern, you know, if I live right, if I do what's wise and follow his pattern for life, then surely life should go well, shouldn't it? And surely I should be able to break free from this futility. And that brings us on to Solomon's second claim. This is verses 16 to 18, which is that even wisdom can't bring ultimate gain. Have a look at 16. I said in my heart, I have acquired great wisdom, surpassing all who were over Jerusalem before me, and my heart has had great experience of wisdom and knowledge. And I applied my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. Now, if anyone can tell us about wisdom, surely it is this guy. And what is his conclusion? Verse 17, I perceive that this also is but a striving after wind. In fact, Solomon says, wisdom can actually make life worse. And he finishes with another proverb, For in much wisdom is much vexation, verse 18. And he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. And we're going to see as we go on, that was precisely Solomon's experience. So there's his two claims that he's setting out right at the beginning. And now chapter 2, he's going to give us the evidence that backs up his conclusions. So let's look at evidence for claim number 1. And to prove his point, Solomon sets about climbing every conceivable hill that human beings think might bring gain in this life and might make life ultimately livable and worthwhile. Let's look at his experience. Chapter 2, verse 1. I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure. Enjoy yourself. But behold, this also was vanity. I said of laughter, it is mad, and of pleasure, what use is it? I searched with my heart how to cheer my body with wine. I think it's worth noticing that he didn't temporarily become a complete fool and go on a road trip with his drinking buddies. Throughout the whole exercise, he says, and this is there in verse 3, my heart still guiding me with wisdom and how to lay hold on folly. So he was testing out folly as well, but it was all part of his investigation. Till, he says, I might see what was good for the children of man to do under heaven during the few days of their life. So Solomon tried all these different pursuits, pleasure, comedy, amusement, drinking, but none of it delivered. So what does he do? Well, he keeps going. Verse 4, I made great works. I built houses and planted vineyards for myself. I made myself gardens and parks and planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. I made myself pools from which to water the forest of growing trees. It's interesting, that word for parks there in verse 5 is the word from which we get our word paradise. And this whole description is deliberately Eden-like. It's filled with trees, watered by pools. The point is that Solomon was trying to build heaven here, build a new Eden. And he actually got closer to it than anyone else is going to get. He had phenomenal resources, the kingdom at its peak. Even if it was his attempt mixed up with some additions which certainly weren't in the original Eden. And he keeps going, verse 7, I bought male and female slaves and had slaves who were born in my house. I had also great possessions of herds and flocks, more than any who had been before me in Jerusalem. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the treasure of kings and provinces. I got singers, both men and women, and many concubines, the delight of the children of man. So I became great and surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also my wisdom remained with me. And the point is, there was nothing left out here. There was nothing where someone could say, yes, but your investigation was a bit limited, wasn't it? What about this? Have a look at verse 10. And whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. A comprehensive survey. Verse 11. Then I considered all that my hands had done and the toil I had expended in doing it, and behold, all was vapor and a striving after wind. And here's the key phrase, and there was nothing to be gained under the sun. Do you remember chapter 1, verse 3? God has so frustrated this life that there is no pursuit that is ultimately worthwhile and purposeful and lasting in this life. And this Eden language here, this idea of building heaven here, is very revealing. How many of us are basically living for building heaven here? And it's always just that little bit away. If I can just finish my training, if I can just find that life partner, if I can just start a family, if I can just get the baby to sleep through, if I can just get them into school, if I can just get them through uni, if I can just get that house, if I can just get that promotion, then we say, life will be good. We spend our lives thinking we can build heaven here. It's just over the horizon. And Solomon wants to tell us it is not going to work. Solomon knew that he had a unique role as Israel's wise man par excellence, and he's recorded all this for our benefit so that whatever hill we are currently walking up, he says to us, look, I've been there, I've actually been to the top, and they are lying to you. You cannot do it. You cannot build heaven here. It's not going to deliver what it promises. God has frustrated this life deliberately, he says. And so the way of wisdom means not thinking that we know better than Solomon. We don't. One person who, like Solomon, had the ability and resources to climb every hill, it seemed, was a guy called Howard Hughes. You might know him. He's the guy Leonardo DiCaprio played in that film, The Aviator. And Howard Hughes was America's first billionaire. And one person has written this about him. All he ever really wanted in life was more. He wanted more money, so he invested into a $1 billion pile of assets. He wanted more fame, so he broke into the Hollywood scene and became a filmmaker and star. He wanted more sensual pleasures, so he paid to get to indulge his every sexual urge. He wanted more thrills, so he designed, built, and piloted the fastest aircraft in the world. He wanted more power, so he dealt political favors so that 2 US presidents became his pawns. All he ever wanted was more, convinced that more would bring him true satisfaction. And this writer says, unfortunately, history shows otherwise. He concluded his life emaciated, fingernails in grotesque corkscrews, rotting black teeth, and innumerable needle marks from his drug addiction. Howard Hughes died a billionaire junkie, believing the myth of more. Don't fall for it. Now, we might be thinking, especially when we hear about Howard Hughes, but surely he was driven by his lusts. Surely things would be different for me if I were living a careful, upright, wise life. And Solomon's ready for you, and he says, don't be fooled. And next comes his evidence for why, and this we saw this, even wisdom can't bring ultimate gain. And what's his argument here? Well, Solomon is certainly not anti-wisdom. I mean, that's a bit of an understatement if you know anything about him, just as the Pope's not anti-Catholic. You know, Solomon loves wisdom. So first, Solomon acknowledges that wisdom is a beautiful and wonderful thing. Verse 13, then I saw there is more gain in wisdom than in folly, as there is more gain in light than in darkness. There's no question. It's not that he thinks wisdom is meaningless or irrelevant. And then he gives what I think is probably another proverb. Verse 14, the wise person has his eyes in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. Wisdom's good. But the point is, however wonderful wisdom is, it cannot bring ultimate gain. 14b, and yet I perceived that the same event happens to all of them. And he's introducing death. Death. One of the most memorable parts of being a first-year medical student is the dissection room. And if you've been there, as some in this room will have done, there's corpses laid out in rows on tables, usually about 4 students per corpse, and it's actually quite a lot of fun. And it's you get to know this individual quite well in a weird kind of way, and there may be some things that you can discover about their lives. You can discover about their smoking habits, their eating habits, perhaps. But at the end of the day, whether they were wise or foolish in their lives, whether they were postmen or prime ministers, laid out there in that room, they all look very similar. Just slabs of meat on a table. In some ways, Leo Tolstoy, the Russian novelist and aristocrat, he was a little bit like the Solomon of his day. And he too went on a quest to discover what life is really about. And initially, he decided deliberately, like Solomon does, that he will go after pleasure. And at university, he drank heavily. He lived promiscuously. He gambled. But he discovered that that life was very empty. Then he decided to pursue relationships. And he married a loving wife. He had 13 children. It seems like he's a guy who never did anything by halves. And again, he discovered that it wasn't fulfilling in the way he had hoped. So he decided to go hard after wealth and after fame. What did he do? He wrote War and Peace. Now, I think it would be a great achievement to read War and Peace. He decided to write it. Anyway, he actually wrote some of the finest works of literature in any language. But through it all, he said, there was one question which haunted him, even to the verge of suicide. And that question was this: is there any meaning in my life which will not be annihilated by the inevitability of death which awaits me? He had worked it out. He realized that however wise, however foolish we are, it makes no difference ultimately. Death will get us in the end. And Solomon wants us to be clear, not simply that death renders our wisdom ultimately meaningless, but that death renders achievements ultimately meaningless. Some of us will be thinking, well, yeah, I know I'm going to die, but I can still contribute to something that will last, won't it, beyond my death. Solomon says, really? You sure about that? Verse 18, well, I hated all my toil in which I toil under the sun, seeing that I must leave it to the man who will come after me. And who knows whether he will be wise or a fool? Yet he will be master of all for which I toiled and used my wisdom under the sun. It is possible to spend your whole life trying to split the atom and then for someone after you to use your knowledge not to improve life, but to kill millions of people. It is possible to spend your life building up a church even, with loads of people, a great reputation in the community. Within a generation, it's being used to propagate a different message altogether. It is possible to leave money for your family and for that very wealth to spoil and corrupt the grandchildren that you are trying to bless. As Woody Allen put it, death renders anyone's accomplishments meaningless. Solomon could see that we can't even secure our legacy for 100 years, let alone 100,000. But then, having established his case that God has frustrated this life and that even wisdom can't bring ultimate gain, Solomon now leaves us with two very positive messages. I can see a kind of gasp of relief. Positive messages of how it is that we can now live wisely in this life. And actually, these are the exact same two headings that we looked at last week. This is how to reinforce it, hopefully. But here are the verses that we got them from last week. And the positive message A there on the sheet: life's about gifts more than gain. Verse 22, what has a man from all the toil and striving of heart with which he toils beneath the sun? Do you note there, it's almost the same question that Solomon began with back in chapter 1, verse 3. Where's the gain? Where's the gain? But now he shows what kind of a life comes from being obsessed with that question. Verse 23, for all his days are full of sorrow, and his work is a vexation. And now some additional evidence that this is an unhealthy question to be obsessed with. Even in the night, his heart does not rest. That's a mark in the Bible of the ungodly person in Psalm 127. This also is vanity. And Solomon has discovered that this obsession with the question, where's the gain, where's the gain, is the tried and tested route to a stressed out and ultimately vain life. And so instead of getting to the end of each day and asking, what have I achieved? What have I achieved? And we thought about this last week, didn't we? It's much healthier to get to the end of our day and ask, what have I received? What have I received? And we thought last week about this practice of carefully acknowledging God as the generous giver of everything good we've received that day. Look at verse 24 again. There is nothing better for a person than that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. This also I saw is from the hand of God. For apart from him, who can eat or who can have enjoyment? We thought about last week, what if life wasn't a computer game about achieving the most gain before the time runs out? What if life rather was an arena in which we as creatures get to receive gifts from our Creator so we can come to enjoy Him and know Him better? What if God our Creator has the same way of operating as God our Saviour? Sheer grace. And Solomon wants us to see that actually life is about gifts more than about gain. But the second positive message for how to live wisely in this life is, number B there, that we can entrust gain to God. Now, I think this is a really fascinating end to this section. Solomon describes two kinds of people, which is what wisdom literature often does, righteous and the wicked, or as Solomon describes them here, the one who pleases God and the sinner. This is verse 26, look with me. For to the one who pleases him, God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy. But to the sinner, he has given the business of gathering and collecting, only to give to the one who pleases God. And for the sinner, there's no escaping that this also is vanity and a striving after wind. Now, notice a few things here about that verse. It must be that Solomon is talking about a future judgment. It must be that he's talking about a future settling of accounts. Think about it. He's just told us in verse 19 that in this life, we can't be sure whether the wise or the foolish will end up with possessions. That's why he's so nervous about who he's going to leave his money to. But in verse 26, it's very definitely the godly who are going to end up with their hands full. So verse 26 must be looking beyond this life. And notice what characterizes each group as well. The sinners are characterized by that verb, gathering. That's exactly what Solomon was up to in chapter 2, verse 8, when he was obsessed by, where's the gain? Where's the gain? Gathering. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the treasure of kings and provinces. And that is contrasted, but the one who pleases God, is characterized not by gathering, but by receiving gifts, namely wisdom and knowledge and joy. I.e., the godly are those who have stepped out of that stress head mindset of where's the gain, and have started putting into practice verse 24 to 25, this new mindset of acknowledging God in the ordinary things of life and finding contentment, even finding joy in ordinary things that God has given us. And thirdly, the big shock in this verse for me is that for those people, paradoxically, there is gain. Did you notice that the sinner was given the business of gathering and collecting in verse 26? That's a direct reference back to chapter 1, verse 13, where Solomon described the unhappy business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. So the ungodly, those who are obsessed with gain, are trapped in this cursed world of futility, this business that we've been given. And yet, somehow, in a way that is hinted at but not fully explained here in Ecclesiastes, the godly are freed from that futility. Somehow, verse 26 says, they will receive, ultimately, the fruits of the sinner's labor. Isn't that amazing? We began with that question, can we really make a lasting difference in this life? And we've seen, you know, all this argument so far that the answer of this passage for the unbeliever is a resounding no. No, you can't. And yet here in verse 26, for the believer, for the one who pleases God, the one who learns to receive God's wisdom and receive God's gifts in thankfulness, and to look to him for the as yet unseen reward, there's a hint here in verse 26 that the answer is yes. We can live in a way which counts for something, ultimately. Now, it's a hint. We're going to have to wait for later in the Bible to see this picture developed and explained. For example, how in Esther, and we saw this at our weekend away, God's people received the plunder from their persecutors. Another little hint. And then we see more clearly in the New Testament how Jesus promises a great reversal is coming. when finally the mighty will be brought down and the humble exalted. When the hungry are fed, Jesus said, and the rich will be sent away empty. But even here we can see that we can entrust gain to God for that final day. And actually, it was this discovery which changed Tolstoy's life completely around. When he heard this Christian teaching about an answer, the only answer to death's futility. When he heard about Jesus' resurrection and he heard about the final resurrection for all those who belong to him. And he discovered that this future hope, this future accounting, is the only thing that can give this life meaning and purpose. And Tolstoy was never the same again. And this discovery changes even the little details of our lives. Those of us in Grace Groups, we've been looking at Mark chapter 9 this week, and even seemingly minor things we're told in that chapter, like giving someone a cup of water in obedience to Christ, will not go unrewarded, Jesus says. Everything, every detail of our lives counts. So paradoxically, in answer to that opening question, can we really make a lasting difference in our lives? The answer is that for those who entrust gain to God, there will be real gain. There will be real reward. As someone has said, only one life, 'twill soon be passed. Only what's done for Christ will last. And this passage declares both negatively that nothing else can last. God has frustrated this life. Even wisdom cannot bring ultimate gain. But positively, this passage declares that everything done in obedience to Christ will last. We can entrust gain to our Creator. We're going to pause there and have a time in quiet, perhaps to look over the verses and to reflect before God on what this means for us. I've put a coffee question as well, perhaps to discuss this evening or during the week with others. And then in a minute, we're going to have a song played to us. So when the musicians start, don't stand as normal, but just listen in. And it's a song about how our identity is in God and not in this fleeting world.